Welcome to JourneyWithJesus.net, a weekly webzine for the global church, now with readers in over 180 countries. I'm Daniel B. Clendenin. My essay this week is called Mary, the Lord's Servant, and is based upon the lecture readings for Sunday, December 18th, 2005, the fourth Sunday in Advent. In his gospel this week, the physician Luke tells the story of two births. The angel Gabriel announced both of these births to the parents, but Christians celebrate only one of them, at the Feast of the Annunciation every March 23rd, precisely 9 months before we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ. Why? Because in the words of the Oxford poet U.A. Fanthorpe, this was the moment when before turned into after, in the future's uninvented timekeepers presented arms. With the attention to detail that you would expect from a physician, the differences between these two birth narratives are striking. Luke recounts the birth of John the Baptist from the viewpoint of his father. Zechariah was a married man, too old, we might say, for sex, and his wife was barren. He was a member of the religious establishment in the holy city of Jerusalem, a priest of the professional class. His vision of the angel Gabriel occurred in the inner sanctuary of the temple. When Gabriel foretold the birth of his son, John the Baptist, Zechariah responded in disbelief and consequently was struck silent so that he couldn't speak. The birth narrative of Jesus, on the other hand, is told from the viewpoint of his mother. Mary was a single teenage girl, too young for sex. Given the strongly patriarchal nature of the society in her time and place, Joseph, to whom she was betrothed, is notable for his invisibility in this story. Mary was a peasant girl from a working-class neighborhood of carpenters in Nazareth, a village so insignificant that it is not mentioned in the Old Testament, not by the historian Josephus, nor in the Jewish Talmud. We read in John 1:46, for example, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Her encounter took place not in the temple, but in an unknown, ordinary house. When the angel Gabriel foretold the birth of her son, Jesus, Mary responded in words of faith that have echoed through the centuries. "I am the Lord's servant. May it be to me as you have said." Her bold belief startled her pregnant cousin, Elizabeth, who exclaimed, as Luke puts it, in a loud voice, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the child you will bear. Blessed is she who has believed that what the Lord has said to her will be accomplished." Luke 1:38, 42, and 45. Whereas Zechariah was struck silent for his unbelief, Mary praised God in her majestic Magnificat. The Son of Mary, Jesus, would be the Son of God, God made flesh. Christians in the Eastern Orthodox tradition remind us of a remarkable truth when they therefore honor Mary with a technical term, Theotokos, or bearer of God, in their special hymn, which reads like this: "Today is the beginning of our salvation, the revelation of the eternal mystery. The Son of God becomes the Son of the Virgin, as Gabriel announces the coming of grace. Together with him, let us cry to the Theotokos, rejoice, O full of grace, the Lord is with you." This technical term, Theotokos, bestowed upon Mary by church fathers since the 3rd century, acknowledges her special role in redemption. She is nothing less than the Mother of God. But when it gained official status at the Third Ecumenical Council of Ephesus in 431, the intent of this term was to emphasize the full divinity of the Son more than the privileged status of his mother. Mary did not give birth to a mere man, a Christotokos, as the Nestorians taught. No, she bore a child who was fully divine. Christians also worship Jesus as the Son of Man, and in Gabriel's Annunciation, we confess the integrity of his human nature. In that cultural milieu, where many men and a few women claim divine status, the startling claim of Christians was not that man became a god, but that in Jesus, God became a man. Because of his birth to Mary, Christians insist that Jesus is fully and truly human. Our Roman Catholic friends remind us of another Marian truth. In some mysterious way, the Incarnation resulted not only from the work of God the Father, but also from the will of the Mother Mary. Numerous Church Fathers acknowledge Mary's active cooperation in the history of salvation. According to Thomas Aquinas, for example, human redemption depended upon the consent of the pregnant teenager Mary. She did not ask to bear the Son of God, nor was she compelled to do so. She might have said no, or like Zechariah, responded to Gabriel's staggering annunciation in disbelief. But she did not shrink from God's call on her life, and instead enriched all humanity by her willing participation and by her obedient submission. For that, we honor Mary. For their part, and to their loss, Protestants have tiptoed around Mary, fearing that such exalted language about her veers too close to making her a co-redeemer of humanity. Anything that elevates Mary to that degree is cause for concern. In more syncretistic and popular forms of Christian folk religion, among uneducated people, it's not difficult to find such abuses. Protestants have also taken exceptions to dogmatic formulations about Mary that were made much later and that do not enjoy clear biblical support. For example, the notion that she was free from both actual and even original sin, called the Immaculate Conception, which was codified in 1854, or the idea that after her death she was taken directly to heaven, known as the Bodily Assumption, 1950. So Protestants rightly press a caution that, in fact, both Catholics and Orthodox believers themselves acknowledge, that we honor or venerate Mary as the Mother of God, but we do not offer her our worship, which is due to God alone. Genuine veneration of the Mother of God should lead to unambiguous exaltation of the Son of God. Mary played a unique role in the mystery of salvation, whereby God humbled himself to be born as the baby of a peasant teenager in order to reconcile the world to himself. We can only stand in awe of this woman who was faithful to God's call to such an improbable role in redemption. It's no wonder that Mary has become the subject of art and a cultural force throughout the world. The 16th century poet John Donne plumbs the depths of this profound mystery, as only poetry might, in his sonnet, Annunciation. Salvation to all that will is nigh, that all, which always is all everywhere, which cannot sin, and yet all sins must bear, which cannot die, yet cannot choose but die, lo, faithful virgin, yields himself to lie in prison in thy womb. And though he there can take no sin, nor thou give, yet he will wear, taken from thence, flesh, which death's force may try. Ere by the spheres time was created, thou wast in his mind, who is thy son and brother, whom thou conceivest, conceived. Yea, thou art now thy maker's maker, and thy father's mother. Thou hast light in dark, and shut'st in little room, immensity cloistered in thy dear womb. An ancient Christian hymn put it even more succinctly, quote, "He whom the entire universe could not contain was contained within your womb, O Theotokos," end quote. In other words, Mariology, devotion to Mary, originates from and leads directly to Christology, the worship of Jesus at this Christmas time. For further reflection, here are a few questions. 1. How have you understood Mary's place in the Gospels? 2. What might we gain from the particular emphases of the Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant traditions about Mary? 3. What do you take from Donne's sonnet about Mary's relationship to Jesus? And finally, for further study, see Yaroslav Pelikan's wonderful book, Mary Through the Centuries, Her Place in the History of Culture. My book note for December 18th is of a brand new novel by Anne Rice called Christ the Lord, Out of Egypt, New York, Knopf, 2005, 322 pages. Anne Rice's enthusiastic fans love her for her 25 novels of fantasy that explore vampires, witches, and the occult, not to mention homoeroticism and sadomasochism, which is why many people were stunned to read a Newsweek article in October 2005 where Rice promised that henceforth she would write, quote, only for the Lord, end quote. In fact, in a touching and candid author's note at the end of Christ the Lord, Rice recounts her strict upbringing in an Irish Catholic family, how and why she left the church for 40 years, her 41-year marriage to an ardent atheist, Stan Rice, who died in 2002 of a brain tumor, and finally, her return to the Catholic Church in 1998. Now she says she is, quote, ready to do violence to my career. I consecrated myself and my work to Christ, end quote. The present novel is her first installment of a trilogy she intends to write on the life of Christ. Rice has Jesus himself as a 7-year-old boy narrate this novel. And since we know virtually nothing about the childhood of Jesus, she's ventured into the provocative realm of historical fiction, much as Frederick Buechner reimagined the life of the patriarch Jacob in his wonderful novel, Son of Laughter. What Rice has attempted, then, is to explore what theologians call the messianic consciousness of Jesus. That is, just how, when, and why did the fully human Jesus begin to realize exactly who he was? For a novelist, this presents an extraordinarily complex challenge of character development, and readers will have to decide for themselves whether Rice has been successful in getting inside the head of a 7-year-old. The novel opens when Jesus, only 7 years old, curses a playground bully who consequently dies, and later raises him to life with yet another sort of spontaneous wish prayer. Even then, Jesus, quote, felt the power go out of me, end quote. A few pages later, she also includes the apocryphal account from the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus turns clay pots into flying birds. But then life settles down for 200 pages or so, and Rice takes the Holy Family out of Alexandria, Egypt, where Jesus spent the first 7 years of his life, including study with Philo, back to Jerusalem, and then on to Nazareth. Family silence and secrets about strange events surrounding his birth provoke Jesus' curiosity. But no one is speaking. Only in the last 50 pages does the novel really heat up when Jesus' brother James, a 13-year-old, tells Jesus what he himself saw and witnessed at the Nativity. In the final few pages, his mother Mary, then about 20, also tells Jesus how as a pregnant 13-year-old, She was told that he would be, quote, the begotten of God, end quote. And thus, Jesus' first year in his own land ends. For what happens next, we'll have to wait for Rice's second installment, much of which, she says, is already written. My film review this week is of March of the Penguins, 2005. In this National Geographic documentary, the filmmakers take you through a year in the life of Antarctica's emperor penguins. The director, Luc Jacquet, pitches this as a romantic story of migration and mating, in which thousands of penguins waddle and glide 70 miles across an icy wasteland to the exact same place year after year, often in single file, to bear their young. Their foreboding geography is fascinating, and the cinematography remarkable, as they only could be. The technical challenges of making a film like this, where temperatures plunge to minus 70 degrees, boggles the imagination. But I thought the film had trouble finding its exact voice. The music track suggests certain viewpoints, and the narrator's script equivocated between the purely scientific and the crassly cute. Quote, "This is a love story," end quote. We can easily imagine learning much more about these fascinating creatures who thrive in such a harsh environment. Still, March of the Penguins will take its rightful place along other family-friendly, animal-lover films like Winged Migration, The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill, and The Story of the Weeping Camel. And finally this week, for poetry, we've posted the poem entitled B.C.A.D. by U.A. Fanthorpe, who was born in 1929 and was the first woman nominated to be the professor of poetry at Oxford University. This was the moment when before turned into after, and the future's uninvented timekeepers presented arms. This was the moment when nothing happened. Only dull peace sprawled boringly over the earth. This was the moment when even energetic Romans could find nothing better to do than counting heads in remote provinces. And this was the moment when a few farm workers and three members of an obscure Persian sect walked haphazard by starlight straight into the kingdom of heaven. Thank you for joining JourneyWithJesus.net for Sunday, December 18th, 2005. And please join us every Monday for a new essay, book note, film review, and poem. I'm Daniel B. Clendenin.